The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. A lot to talk about. My guest coming up right after Health and Nutrition will be Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, our entering the age of austerity and how this will shape the future of government and our lives. Now, we know what's happening in Greece. Well, it's going to happen here. So we should walk in the direction of this crisis, understand it, and see who's behind it, what we can do about it. My guest will be Professor Thomas Byron Edsall. He is one of our nation's most respected political journalists and commentators, and he's covered a lot since he began in 1968. His articles have appeared in the Washington Post. He is now the Joseph Pulitzer and Edith Pulitzer Moore Professor of Public Affairs at Columbia University School of Journalism. And he'll be our guest. Then, if time permits, the 12 tipping points. If it does not permit, then I will deal with this on my Sunday evening talkback segment, along with some new information on sugar. Then also, sooner or later I'm going to get to this, I've been wanting to do this, the 7 privacy threats the Constitution cannot protect you against, from Tana Geneva, Aldernet. Things we don't even think about, don't even come into our mind that is being done to us. So we have a lot to share, and we're having a little technical difficulty with our camera, and as soon as that gets fixed in a few moments, you'll be able to watch the program over GaryKnoll.com. Let's begin. First, vegetarian diets get another thumbs up, this one from the American Dietetic Association as published in Science Daily. Here's what it says. Quote, the American Dietetic Association has released an updated position paper on vegetarian diets that concludes that such diets, if well planned, are healthful and nutritious for adults, infants, and children and adolescents and can help prevent and treat chronic diseases, including heart disease, cancer, obesity, and diabetes. From the paper, it says, quote, it is the position of the American Dietetic Association that appropriately planned vegetarian diets, including total vegetarian or vegan diets, are healthful, nutritionally adequate, and may provide health benefits in the prevention and treatment of diseases. Well, we've been saying that all along, so we're glad to see that they're on board now, because for a long time, one of the ways that those of us in the field who were going out to debate were criticized, oh, you believe in that unhealthy vegetarian diet. No, those of us who were vegetarians were healthy vegetarians, and those eating the meat-based traditional diet were unhealthy. But they had the power of the media behind them, and therefore we were put into a defensive position. It's nice to see that when we look at the real science, a healthy vegetarian diet is the best diet. Now, if you are a vegetarian, and a vegan in particular, then you're going to be having more raw food in your diet than the average American. I believe that we should have at least 7 to 9 servings of raw food each day in our diet, and at least 12 servings of fruits and vegetables. That would include those raw. One of the superstars is strawberries. In fact, all the berries are good. This is just from the latest scientific PLOS One, which is a major scientific publication. Here's what it says. Strawberries protect the stomach from alcohol. In experiments, European researchers have proved that eating strawberries reduce the harm that alcohol can cause in the stomach mucosal membrane. A team of Italian, Serbian, and Spanish researchers has confirmed the protecting effect that strawberries have in a mammalian stomach that has been damaged by alcohol. Well, that's good news. Now, why? Because when you have any kind of inflammation in the stomach, you're far more susceptible to gastritis and inflammation of the stomach mucosal membrane. And also we know that then you're more susceptible to viral infections or by non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, such as aspirin, to treat Helicobacter pylori bacteria, which is the primary cause of ulcers. So just imagine alcohol in the stomach and alcohol in the intestine is like pouring alcohol on an open wound. It's going to burn. And that's what it does. It burns. It causes inflammation. So taking strawberries, if you know someone that is drinking, and if they took strawberry juice, fresh made strawberry juice after they drank, it would make an enormous difference in protecting their mucosal. Recently I visited Bill Falloon for a new documentary I'm doing that'll be out this June on what has happened to American medicine and American science that supports American medicine. And right now the title is Pathologizing Science, meaning we have a whole cancer within our body science, especially corporate science, much of government science, proprietary science. And he has been very critical of the FDA and other agencies for using its science to promote drugs of dubious or harmful input upon the American public. But he, more than anyone else in the American media, has explained why too many calories is dangerous. And caloric restriction is crucial to living a long life and a healthy life. Almost every show on television, especially the cooking shows, emphasize high levels of competitive adrenaline pumping aggressiveness. It's no longer good enough to be a chef. You have to be an angry chef. You have to scream and humiliate people like Gordon Ramsay or other people of his ilk. Or you have to be a diabetic who promotes diabetes-causing diseases through the foods, like the one who now we find out has had diabetes for several years and is now going to get a nice fat check from a diabetic medication company and in return continue giving us bad foods. But she got the check. And yet you would think that people would say, isn't this bad food that I'm eating? Isn't this too much food? How can the human body consume this amount of food? The supersizing these meals, eating all this sugar and flour and fried foods, surely this can't be good for you. But you have little or no restraint of getting the information out and people gladly consuming it. People are not stupid. They make stupid choices, but they're not stupid. They're not naive either. No one smokes a cigarette and thinks it's as good as having an orange. No one drinks a glass of alcohol and thinks it's as good as having a glass of tomato juice or apple juice. And we're very good at denying what we've done that ends up causing us a problem. We want to blame someone else. We have become a culture of blame. In fact, I've just written an extensive chapter in my newest book, which will be out sometime in the next year, on how we can live our whole lives without ever once having to take responsibility for a single choice. We literally, as a society, collectively, as governments, as bureaucracies, as unions, as businesses, as individuals, we've mastered the art of triangulating the downside, the dark side, the negative side of our actions, so someone else is always responsible. We never are. Boy, what a difference when I was growing up, and my great uncle, Uncle George, he made it very clear if you made a mistake, stand up, own it, it's yours, what's the lesson from it, so you don't repeat it. And he would actually do it at the dinner table on Sunday, where during the meal, if someone was doing something wrong, he'd ask, talk about it. And the person would talk about it, and then he would say, are we willing to take responsibility? And if the person wasn't, in his own calm way, he would stay on it until you would see very clearly the person should take responsibility. And then you were never expected again to screw up like that. You could do other screw-ups, but not that one, because you learned its lesson. My Uncle George was not unique. Most of the people growing up during the Great Depression had to learn from the mistakes made. Mistakes are normal, part of living. But when you repeatedly make a mistake, that's when it gets bad. Today, we have an entire generation, with very few exceptions, that not only take no responsibility for the mistakes they make, they're unaware that they're mistakes, and they could care less. So I will read in the next week this particular chapter, just to give you my input, and you can give me yours. In any case, so when you sit down and you start eating an enormous amount of calories, and these are empty calories, these are junk calories, we shouldn't then be surprised when we end up with pre-diabetes, diabetes. Our children are morbidly obese. They have heart disease. They have arthritis. I was just counseling a family of five where three of the children are morbidly obese. One child is three, one is five, and one is seven. Two of the children have arthritis, and one has heart disease. All because of how they were fed and why they don't do any exercise. They hopefully now will get themselves healthy. But it all started by not talking about the diet. It started about responsibility. Are you willing now to say no to things on television or no to your own eating, because the adults were also overweight, and take responsibility? If not, then understand that your kids are in all likelihood going to die before you. The man said, well, that's not right. No, it's not right. But that's what happens when you deny growing up, being responsible for the choices you're making. In any case, just remember, when you eat more calories than what your body needs, according to the Mayo Clinic, you end up increasing memory loss. This is just one study. I'll quote this. This is in the American Academy of Neurology. Quote, we observed a dose response pattern, which simply means the higher the amount of calories, that the greater memory loss. So, cut back on the calories. Now, why? You can cut back on the calories when you go raw, when you go vegan, when you go natural, when you go juices, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, legumes, pulses, tubers, grains, beans. All of those are low calorie. And also, they provide energy and phytonutrients and antioxidants, and they're non-inflammatory. For those using antibiotics for your sinus infections, according to a study at the Washington University School of Medicine, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they don't work. They're ineffective. Quote, patients don't get better faster or have fewer symptoms when they get antibiotics. End quote. But what could help you if you have a sinus infection? Well, how about first and foremost, getting off dairy, then getting off wheat, then spraying colloidal silver in your nose, then going through a one-week detox where you inhale for about 15 minutes in a bowl of hot water, put about 10 drops of lavender and lilac, and those are terrific in aromatherapies, menthol and wintergreen, and then also take vitamin C throughout the day every hour. Lots of juices, about 10 glasses of fresh vegetable juice a day, and see how you feel then. That's one good way of getting rid of sinus infections. Also, they're now looking at a new turmeric, which is the herb, and its active ingredient, curcumin, for helping on Alzheimer's in this particular study. So, more and more, we're saying that curcumin is simply one of the most important nutrients that we can take into our body. Most people don't believe that if they're exposed to short-term air pollution, that there's any problem. Wrong. From the Journal of the American Medical Association, as published in Science Daily, quote, short-term exposure up to 7 days to all major air pollutants is significantly associated with an increased risk of heart attack. And how many people simply get used to pollution? Each time I fly into Los Angeles, first thing I notice is you'll see the haze hanging over the city. And that is, and then for very sensitive people, you'll start to hack, your eyes will burn. You live there for a while, you don't notice it. It's still a problem. So exposure to any air pollution for up to 7 days, you increase your risk of a heart attack. So let's get over this nonsense. Oh, this can't be that bad. It is. And we should pay attention to it. And finally, research reveals the true cost of a burger. This is from Lancaster University. I'll quote this. The report Relative Greenhouse Gas Impacts of Realistic Dietary Choices, published in the journal Energy Policy, says that if everyone swapped their current eating habits for a vegetarian or vegan diet, our greenhouse gas emission savings would be the equivalent of 50% reduction in exhaust pipe emissions from the entire passenger cars and trucks and trains and planes. So that's what it means. So one more reason to go vegan. People didn't realize that animals produce the amount of methane, which then contributes to global warming and the greenhouse gases that they do. But they do, and you could end up, they worked it out, and in this case it was just England, that combined greenhouse gas emissions from the foods we eat in the UK are equivalent to 167 million tons of carbon dioxide, and switching to a vegan diet will cut this substantially. Fresh meat had the highest emissions of all, but meat and cheese had generally high gas greenhouse gas cost. So go vegan and clean up the environment. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting in our studios live, and now our video stream has been corrected, and you can watch today's program by going to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and within a week, as soon as the new cameras come in, our full studio will be in operation. We're going to go to our guest with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, Professor Thomas Byron Edsall, talking about austerity. It's coming. What does it mean? How will it impact us? That's what we're going to discuss with this gentleman. And as I mentioned earlier in the program when I read you his background, he is a Joseph Pulitzer and Edith Pulitzer Moore Professor of Public Affairs at Columbia University School of Journalism and hosts an online election column in the New York Times website. He's published 5 books on American political atmosphere. His most recent is The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics, which clearly defines the extreme polarization that has unfolded between Democrats and Republicans, as well as within the American public. We'll go to him in just a moment. Then after that, if time permits, the 12 tipping points in depth. Now, this past Monday evening, I had some of the world's leading scholars on environmental tipping points, those who've actually gone to Antarctica and the great glaciers in the Himalayas and Greenland and observed what is happening, and I've written papers on it. It's a very powerful 1 hour. You can go to the archives and download that important program. It's part of our Progressive Commentary Hour. But I wanted to add on to it because I was letting them do all the talking as I wanted their insight. But now I want to share with you all of the tipping points in lay language, what they are, what we can do about them, and why you should know about this. And then, time permitting, and I'm not sure it is, the 7 privacy threats the Constitution cannot protect you against. And I'll go through each one of these and why we should be concerned, like biometrics and everything you use all the time, and government databases and the future attribute screening technology, what is called FAST and drones, things we just don't think about. They're not in our conscious, they're not in our daily patterns. But large industries have been put into place that are supposedly protecting our interest. And I'm concerned that there has been no transparency. This has not been up for discussion with the American media and those of us in the independent or progressive movement having an opportunity to ask the critical questions that those in the more corporatized left and the right media have simply refused to touch on. So that's that. Now, one quick program announcement. Actually, two. For those of you living up in Westchester, I will be doing a free lecture on this. On March 7th at 6 p.m., and that will be at A Matter of Health in Nanuet. And the phone number for reservations is 845-627-3333, 845-627-3333. But now here's what's really important. On the same evening, I am premiering my brand new feature documentary, American Veterans, Forgotten and Neglected. This has been a project that's taken me almost 19 years, and I'm going to bring you their story. The numbers are just devastating. How many vets have sought help for non-battlefield-related problems, how they've been denied that help, how they've ended up suffering, frequently dying. The number is 76,000 deaths, according to a Freedom of Information Act report I have. That's more than died in the Vietnam War, 58,000. How this has been covered up by the VA, who's been involved, former people within the Defense Department, within the Secretary of Defense's own personal office are on film talking about this. This is, and no, none of the major American media have touched on this. But then I took it, it's in two parts, the film's a long film, it's 2 hours and 15 minutes long, my films are an hour and a half, but I couldn't squeeze the whole story in anything less. And the film's in two parts. The first part shows you all about their suffering and what they were exposed to. The second part shows you how they live today when there is no help for them, when they're abandoned. And the numbers are just mind-boggling. I found 16,000 of them in just one small area of the woods in central Florida. And I filmed them there. I found them all over the place. I found them sleeping at the base of some of the Red Rock Mountains out in Arizona, in Sedona. Yet when I asked the spiritual people in the community there, the artists have been out there to help these homeless vets, feed them, talk with them, shelter them? No. What kind of spiritual community is this where you don't take care of... Well, they didn't want to talk about that. I'm just finding a lot of problems with why the American public has not been more concerned about what happens to these vets once they come home. You can be against the war, but you don't need to be against the vets. Now they're alcoholic, they're drug addict, they're in prison, the highest rate of suicide. You know, this is their story as I've filmed it. And the premiere of this new feature film will be on one night only, one showing only. That's it. March 7th, 7 p.m., if you want to come to this showing, it'll be at a major theater, the Lowe's Theater, and on the Upper West Side. You have to call and make a reservation, and you can call at 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. It'll be sold out, so you can't just show up at the door. You have to have a ticket and to get in. It's 877-627-5065. I have four feature films I'll be premiering over the next 14 months. My next one will be in June on Poverty, Inc., but this one is a hard-hitting one, and it's important you see it. I'm bringing in some of the vets for that day, so you can see them, and there'll be an hour Q&A afterwards. I'll be in Rockland County earlier do my lecture, but then while the film's going on, I don't have to be there to introduce the film. But at the end of the film, I will be back in the city and doing the Q&A and introducing some of these very important veterans who are there. Because they have no help, none, zero, nothing. American Veterans, Forgotten and You won't want to miss it. Call 877-627-5065. One and only showing. Now let's go over to my guest who is standing by. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Edsel.
Good to be with you.
I'm going to give a little extended introduction, as I tend to do, and then stay quiet and listen to your extended and in-context answer, all right?
Sure.
I'm concerned that the American public has not been given a chance by our major American media to see the full impact of the structural adjustments in Africa, in South America, in Asia, over the decades, nor now what the European Central Bank or the International Monetary Fund is bringing to bear upon countries such as Greece and Portugal and Spain, Ireland, Latvia, Lithuania, Malta, and other countries that are having a rough time of it. We hear only that the banks are close to a deal of giving them, you know, $180 billion, but they have to cut 22% off their minimum wage, which would mean an average person would make $15,000 a year if they work full-time, and then also 20% of their pensions are going to be gone, 155,000 jobs have to be eliminated in their federal sector, private properties have to be auctioned off through privatization efforts. So we hear about some of this, but we don't know what it means. So for friends of mine who are Greek and friends of mine who live in Greece today, they paint a horrible picture of what's actually happening in all areas. And they tell you the problems, that rich have never paid taxes, that, you know, who has what say. But the average person in Greece is getting thumped. And one friend, who's an academic, said it this way. How long after our parliament gives away that money to the banks, because it comes from the central banks and bond holders who want to get a high interest rate, but it goes right back to the banks. It doesn't end up helping the people in Greece. How long do you think that they're going to stay taking all this when their economy can't rebound? They don't have any money. They don't have any disposable money. Unemployment's only going to grow, and it's going to put them in a place where they're going to feel like they were in Africa in the 1990s under structural adjustment. They're not going to take it. They're going to go to the streets. They're going to burn down the buildings. They're going to overthrow the government, and then Germany's then going to say, okay, let's drop him out of the European zone before it goes viral, but it'll be too late. He says, Gary, you have no idea what's going on in the American media. Shame on them. They have not even discussed what it means to go through an austerity program because they don't want to show how bad it is. That's part of my issue. My second part is, what about austerity in America? We don't hear from the working Americans who are struggling. We don't hear from the very poor. We don't hear from families that go days without dinner because they just don't have the money. The BBC has to come in and do a special on poverty where they find that a woman had to feed her daughter a rat that she caught because there was no other food. And the little girl said this, and it was verified. One boy hadn't had dinner in 5 days and only had food for breakfast. Kids are taking massive amounts of ketchup out of school and then taking it home so they can make a ketchup soup, something we hadn't heard of since the Great Depression. So the American political system, the American media, in my personal and subjective opinion, has chosen not to focus upon the true austerity that is already in effect happening to many Americans, let alone the likely outcome if we continue down the road we are going now. Those are my concerns. Would you address these, please, and then tie that in with your own unique and historical view of where we're going and what we have to know about it?
You make some very good points. Basically, in much of Europe now, the economic policy is no longer being set by democratic means. The debt, the people who hold the debt, the banks, are really setting the policy through much of the peripheral European states, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland. And they are imposing very severe austerity programs. You mentioned about people going into the streets, burning buildings. Actually, that is already happening. Whether or not there will be a full-fledged upheaval is another. We'll see. It's certainly they are certainly imposing policies on the Greeks that are very difficult and look also as if they never would produce the results that they claim that they want, which is the ability of the Greeks to pay back the money. If anything, the austerity policies constrain the Greek economy in a way that it simply doesn't grow. There is a parallel to what's going on in this country where many people, basically the Republican Party, wants to initiate tough austerity policies in this country to reduce the national debt. And the likelihood is, in fact, there's a pretty strong degree of consensus among economists that initiating that kind of program would not just stall the very tentative recovery that the country is in now, but that would put us back significant steps and make things much worse for everybody, both in terms of the job market and by withdrawing all kinds of federal spending. There is a real bind where there are very strong forces calling for austerity in this country, in Europe. Well, basically those two places are the main centers of the austerity movement. And it's interesting that in this country the Democratic Party is at best ambivalent on this subject, that there are substantial numbers within the Democratic Party who believe that austerity efforts must be taken promptly, and the party is split with another wing, the more liberal wing, in favor of stimulus now and perhaps some budget cutting longer, further down the road. So we are in a dilemma. What it's done is made the political system all the more polarized and all the more hostile, and has created an environment where any kind of resolution of any substantial sort is not very likely on the short-term or medium-term horizon. So basically, in general, the prospects are not good. Let me leave it at that.
Okay, I appreciate your overview. If we could, let's continue the connections on these. In the United States, both the mainstream Democrats, and not the Dennis Kucinich or the independent Bernie Sanders or others or Maxine Waters, but the mainstream Democrats and certainly the mainstream Republicans, with few exception, they're looking at making reductions in debt, but all on the behalf of the American public's like Social Security. Social Security doesn't cost the government, yet they have sold the idea that we have to cut this. And then on our other programs, you can certainly get rid of the fraud in Medicare. You can change some of the ways that we get our drugs so we don't have to pay high prices and save $100 billion a year. But you start taking away and cutting back any further on these social programs, you're going to have even greater poverty for those who are voiceless, those who don't have a constituent in Congress representing their interests. And yet at the same time, and this is what bothers me, we have an increase in spending for militarization. In fact, the president has just been bragging, and I'm going to be doing this as a commentary next week, time does not permit today, where he's bragging about how, you know, we're going to spend more. Now it's going to be up to 76,000 special operatives, Navy SEALs and Green Berets and others, who are going to be stationed all over the world and with full military bases, but so they can act immediately. And I'm thinking, you're willing to continue spending money to fight terrorism like you fought the war on drugs, like you fought the war on poverty and everything else, wrong-minded, but you have no hesitation of spending money on that. They're going to continue spending money on our wars in the Middle East, and yet they're cutting back everything they can for the average person. To me, this does not make any sense. Your thoughts?
Actually, I think there's going to be a squeeze on everybody, and the military faces a pretty substantial cut, and you're getting Republicans are going to fight these cuts tooth and nail, but we're going to have a zero-sum competition in Washington over whose ox gets gored. And so far in that process, the Republicans have shown much greater skill in defending their constituencies compared to the talents of the Democratic Party defending theirs. The Republicans have very successfully fought any tax increase, whereas the policies that have been adopted have generally cut social spending. We now have a situation where, in addition to cutting social spending, there's going to be some cuts in the defense budget, and how those will work and whether they actually will occur, we'll see. But there is a real struggle between the two interests, basically. Basically, people who need government programs and those who see themselves as paying taxes for them, that conflict now in this austerity circumstance has become intense. And for the moment, the basically poor people have been on the losing end of this. And they're likely to, in fact, continue to stay on the losing end.
Also, when I have submitted proposals and put them up on my website of what we could do to employ millions of Americans and in a very practical way, and yet the government's always coming through when they do have a program. It's always those individuals who have the political connections to have a corporation that gets a contract, either a bid or no bid contract, and then the majority of the money that goes to a particular contract. For example, with the original bill to help the states and help the corporations, $555 million went to New York State out of the billions in the original bailout, yet only under 100 new jobs were created because it went to a select number of corporations that kept the money and didn't really put people on the ground working. Why can't we create a different model that excludes us inside the circle of self-dealing?
I mean, you raise very substantial questions. And basically, I would think that the more what you're describing gets any publicity, the more likely it is likely to be ended, basically. I must admit that I have not seen what you described documented. If it's assuming it's true, I would very much like to see that.
I'll be happy to give that to you. We have it both for California and for New York State.
Yeah.
Because I want to know, where did the money go? Why haven't we seen more quality jobs? And why haven't we seen a national effort to de-ghettoize America, which we could do, but their idea of de-ghettoization is gentrification, and we see the consequences of that. I live on the Upper West Side and been here my whole adult life, and I saw what happened when, you know, the neighborhood was gentrified. Apartments and brownstones and everything were rehabilitated, but everyone who had historically had lived here were pushed out, and we just keep pushing the poor out somewhere else as if it weren't already bad enough for them, and now it's an expensive neighborhood they can't live in. That's not de-ghettoization. That is, once again, commodification of an asset, a neighborhood. Another area I'd like for you to talk about, what would you say to those like myself who are independent or progressive who do not see those in our official Democrat and Republican Party having the strength of character to really look at what America needs? And without looking first at who paid the campaign bills, which super PACs are involved, who bundled the money, just set all that aside and say whatever decisions we're going to make it based upon making it a better country and making it better for the people here. And then I see that it's only going to be when we have a legitimate populist third party, which I believe is possible. Do you believe it's possible to have a third party at some point in the future that would stand against the self-interest of the current official Republican Democratic Party to make these changes?
It's possible, but that's a very tough process to achieve. One, it costs a fortune to set up a third party. You have to get on the ballot in all 50 states. In many states, that's a very tortuous process. You have to get signatures. They're very complex often. The political parties make it very difficult. So any mistake on a signature can not only invalidate that signature for getting on the ballot, but invalidate the whole page of signatures. You have to hire lawyers to fight to open up the legal system and access to the ballot. But the problem is basically that to start a third party, you need someone with a very large checkbook. And that's why you saw Ross Perot could do this. He could basically pay the freight for everything that he needed to do to get on the ballot. You also need someone who is charismatic to lead a fight like that if they're going to draw a mass movement. There has to be someone articulating the views that you want, that you're citing, but it has to be someone who can articulate them and get those across to the public. So you need basically money and a person. It's not something that's easy to do. I'm not sure it's possible to do just on the basis of the merits of the issue alone.
Okay, my final question, and it's a segue from what you just said,
yep,
is I believe that we have some extraordinarily charismatic, very high moral standard individuals who are looking not at what's good for them, but what's good for the country. That I believe that we can easily provide. I also believe that bringing other parties together and getting people who historically would not have worked together to work together is important. But what if, like myself, we decided that the existing system was incapable of legitimate reform because the people who would be asked to make reform are the people who it would work against them. So they're like any of the other reform they've done. It's always with all these loopholes. What if we as a public, the majority of it, of the public, said no more money in any campaign, completely changed the way, take all money out of campaigns, as other countries have done, and start from scratch? It may be an uphill battle, but it's better than continuing to believe that the existing system, the two-party system, represents the corporate interests on both sides, are going to make a difference. Your thoughts on this, please.
It's a good fight to have, but you really, in order to win that fight and to eliminate money from campaigns, you need to change the Constitution or change the Supreme Court, one of the two, because right now prohibiting money in campaigns is something that the Supreme Court does not accept as constitutional. They consider that to be a violation of free speech. You can disagree with that, and the only way you need either to replace one of the five conservative Supreme Court members, or you need to have a constitutional convention or a constitutional amendment enacted. And that's an avenue. The constitutional amendment process is a potential avenue, and there are people like Lawrence Lessig, who is a severe critic of the whole system, who actually supports a movement of the kind you're talking about to get money out of campaigns. Don't forget, though, you take the money out of campaigns. Corporations in the United States have shown a great talent to deal with all kinds of reforms, and money finds its way into the system through all kinds of avenues. The lobbying business in Washington, just what's disclosed, is now a $3.5 billion industry per year.
And everything you're saying, sir, is absolutely correct. And against that, I would say spring awakening. I would say occupy everything. Finally, America's youth have reminded America's adults, and especially my worthless generation of baby boomers, selfish, conceited, self-interested as we have been, that there is something greater to live for than just the possessions we will accumulate, and they have embarrassed us into paying attention to issues we haven't. So against all the power, against all the elite, I want to remind all the people that we, with all of our military might and $3 billion a year, we supported Mubarak, and we supported all the 22, with one exception, all the 22 Arab League nations. We've supported dictatorships that were impervious and indifferent to the struggles within their own house until one day the house burnt down. So is it impossible to have change in America? No. Is it difficult? Yes. Do we have a mindset now that we're really angry? Yeah. But I'm saying give it another 5 years, and then let's see how powerful and tough these people are. Remember, these are just people. At the end of the day, the Koch brothers and all the rest, they're just human beings. They may not act like them, but they're human beings. I believe that we can have change. I'm optimistic about the future, though I see it's going to be rough. And I certainly appreciate your perspective. It's more pragmatic, and we need that to keep a sense of balance.
Well, go for it.
The SAL, author of The Age of Austerity, and we are entering a severe age of austerity. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment for the next part of our program. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I will save my 12 tipping points for my Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Talkback hour, all about health and nutrition and environmental issues. But I will explain now about the 7 privacy threats the Constitution can't protect you against from Tana Ganeva of Alternet, and then ask you to call in and share your points of view on this. But before we go to there, we have coming up on Monday evening the most downloaded radio program I'm aware of in the United States, commercial or non-commercial Progressive Commentary Hour. And Richard Gale, our executive producer, is in studio. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary.
Who do we have? What's the topic?
Okay, for this Monday, this is February 20th, and we start at 7 p.m. to 8 on the Progressive Commentary Hour. We're going to be looking back at the founding of the Department of Homeland Security's, the passage and the different renewals of the Patriot Act, and what has been consequent to that, the development of a surveillance state leading to a police state that many progressive journalists have been writing about. And so joining our program will be Professor James Petras, who's professor of emeritus of sociology and a very harsh critic of American imperialism. Professor Andrew Cullen will return, a political scientist at Hilbert College and specializes in the conflict between democracy, freedom, and national policing and security. And then Professor John Cozy, who's a very prolific researcher and writer, a variety of political, foreign policy, economic topics for the Center for Research and Globalization at the University of Ottawa. So those are 3, and perhaps some others will be joining us as well.
Good. So if you want to know about where we're going, how we got there with the erosion of our rights, the threat to our constitutional rights and Bill of Rights, and what we can do about it, some of the finest scholarly minds in the country will be sharing. And by the way, I do not limit our program to an hour. However long it takes, that's how long we go. Thank you, Richard.
Okay, thank you.
Monday evening, 7 p.m., every Monday evening, 7 p.m. Richard Polineski, who heads our film division here. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary.
Richard, I mentioned earlier that we have a one-night-only premiere. Now, the last film we did, Knocking on the Devil's Door, as well as Death by Medicine, we did 14 showings, plus Long Island, Huntington Art Cinema in New Jersey, and then 14 in Los Angeles. With this one, we're having just one night. But we're doing it at the largest theater on the Upper West Side, the Lowe's Theater, on March 7th at 7 p.m. And tell us about why this is so important and people should come and support it and support the vets and become aware, become educated, because we're bringing in Doug Roeke and some of the other vets who are in the film from around the United States.
Absolutely. Not only is it a limited engagement, literally one night, and there's limited seating for this, so it's important if you are interested to get in ASAP. But the point is that this is an issue that most people have not heard of.
No.
We're talking about very intelligent, well-read, well-informed people like the listeners in this audience. They're not aware of this issue because it's just not being covered in the media or anywhere else.
No one has gone where we've gone. We have filmed in Fallujah. We have filmed throughout the world. We have filmed hundreds and hundreds of hours to see what it's like to be a vet who is sick but no one will help them, and a vet who is homeless and no one will shelter them. This is their story, and it's an embarrassment, but it's necessary that we show this film. And I'm going to give two copies of the film for everyone who attends so they can give it to other people. So if you want to join me, and Richard Polonesky will be there, and March 7th, 7 p.m., 2 hours, 15 minutes, and an hour, and Q&A afterwards, call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Gary.
And so that's one evening, one showing only. That's it. So that's it in New York. So it'll be packed, and I want everyone to have a chance to get in because they know this is our newest film, and Richard's just finished. In fact, we just went over and saw it up on the big screen to test it, make sure color corrections and how it looked, and it looked great. Now, seven privacy threats the Constitution cannot protect you against. One, everything you use all the time. And that means just think of all the things that you have, your car, your cell phone. You can be tracked now almost anywhere and everywhere. Your credit cards, the embedding of GPS data, so that even the money you're using. They have a way of tracking what you buy, where you buy, where you talk, what you talk on, any photos, anything you've ever done on a cell phone or a computer. They can track that and do. They have no limitation on what they can get about you. And Google, Facebook, Verizon, AT&T, just imagine they have all been sharing this data with the federal agencies. Secondly, cameras everywhere, license plate readers, movement tracking on cameras. And thanks in part to a decade of Homeland Security grants, American cities are just teeming with cameras. They're on subways, buses, storefronts, restaurants, apartment building complexes, and schools. And so you can't go anywhere. But really serious is biometrics. As cameras become more sophisticated and better able to capture high-quality images from further away, there's a push to merge surveillance with biometrics technology, the use of unique physiological features like having everyone in America have their irises scanned, everyone having an iris fingerprint and voice analysis, having your blood chemistry done. How about that? Oh, yeah, it's here. They want to be able at any time to have everything that they need about you, your DNA, everything. So if they want to find out where you're at, all they have to do is put it in the computer, and suddenly it would match wherever you're being tracked anywhere in America. So you would have no place to go where you wouldn't be known. Then government databases. Privacy advocates point out that novel types of biometric technology, like facial recognition, iris scans, are common. And so now the government's developing even further databases so that everything that we've done from the movies we've seen, if you've been on a dating service, everything you've written about yourself, who you've dated, so they have a record of everyone you've ever been with, all this. And then what is called FAST, Future Attribute Screening Technology. And then there's this, it's a technology that's supposed to appear inside your head. Now get this. The Department of Homeland Security Lab tested a program called Future Attribute Screening Technologies designed to thwart criminal activity by predicting malintent. So, in other words, if you had a thought that caused your heart rate to increase or pheromones or electrodermal activity or respiratory measurements that would go in a particular direction, that would tell them you may have the intent to commit a crime, therefore you'd be monitored and arrested, preemptively arresting you. Remember that Tom Cruise movie? Well, that's what they're doing now. This isn't sci-fi for the future. And yet you realize that no one in the media has challenged them on this. No one in our government has challenged them on this. It's like, okay, this next time you get your, and they'll do it this way. Oh, we have to get your new photograph for your driver's license, but we're also going to get a closer picture. You're scanning your eyes, and we're going to get a blood work up. And Americans just lining up as if they're a bunch of idiot robots, don't care about their own protections. And then super drones everywhere. 30,000 now are going to be flying over America. And they're going to have all this material in there so they can watch everything you're doing at any time. So you won't see the drones. The drones will see you. So is that what we've come to? Where's the Democrats? We'll forget them. They're the problem. Where are the Republicans? Well, they've never seen a problem as long as this big government helping make our lives more miserable. But hold on, wasn't that supposed to be what they were against? Yeah, but like everything else they say, it's all contradictory to the truth. The truth is we become a police fascist state. Those are my thoughts. We're out of time. I thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. This is the station that will not blink in the face of adversity and share the issues that we need to hear about, even if we feel uncomfortable exploring them. And everything we say is fully documented.
Got to get you off of my mind. I know it's just a matter of time. You found somebody new. Our romance is through. Yes, it is. Gonna throw your picture away. You didn't want my love any old way. You found somebody new. Our romance is through. Yes, it is. Some folks' love is hard and strong. That's the kind of love that lingers on. Some folks' love is swift and fast.